Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. I'm just taking a windy path through the woods, and in a minute I'll just come down the bank and get onto the canal towpath and have my constitutional. The other day I did a podcast about left and right and the kind of current terminology that's been hung upon events, and particularly the rise globally of a sort of emboldened ethnic nationalism or general far-right tendency. Now, I kind of complained about these labels a little bit, and I did indicate that the so-called alt-right, on its own appraisal, has memed itself into existence. Even though it seems that some tendencies and groupings that have kind of kept their head down for a bit have felt emboldened to pop out of the woodwork and wave flags and carry weapons in public demonstrations and rallies and so forth. And of course we had a near miss in France with Marine Le Pen getting into the finals of the presidential race. Well, okay, she lost, but we did. I suppose the French, for their troubles, got themselves a bankster for president. Anyway, I think what I wanted to say there, that there is more complexity and nuance in the situation than the internet-fed sound bites and memes would have us think. And I had done a podcast previously on this matter, which I'd entitled Cosmopolitanism. I didn't release it because I wasn't entirely satisfied with it, and I think I needed to do more research. But I had been fired to say something about this by watching some of the outright apologists and intellectual prize fighters on YouTube. Because you'll always find with popular movements or mass movements that underneath, behind the scenes, there'll be somebody doing some cutting-edge research looking to give their movement unimpeachable intellectual credentials. Grounding, philosophical grounding even, is what you get. And I did mention in the last podcast how alt-right ideologues have been mining Heidegger, and particularly I think he's called Greg Thomas, I think. I'm just hopeless with names these days, but anyway, the bloke seems to have some exegetical skills, I would say. And the gist of the argument is that cosmopolitanism, which in some articulations, in sort of current discourse, is equated with humanism, is somehow at the root of all of our troubles in the modern world. And at least one pundit has mined Heidegger's light notebook, called the Black Notebooks, for ammunition, as it were, in this project of giving outright ideology a certain grounding and a certain intellectual solidity. Now, calling on Heidegger, I suppose, is an ambiguous move. Heidegger, of course, was a card-carrying Nazi from the 1930s onwards, and after the war, the Americans didn't allow him to teach in the universities for some time, even though he remained active as an intellectual in some other spheres. And infamously, Heidegger never apologised directly for the Holocaust and so forth. So, the reverberations of those Heideggerian biographical moments is still rippling on. I mean, Heidegger is still creating waves, and creating waves in virtue of having been a Nazi and in virtue of not having apologised and so on. I mean, none of this would really, in the scheme of things, be of much import. But for the fact that Heidegger was one of the most brilliant minds of the 20th century, in some respects. Maybe he lacked emotional intelligence, but he certainly sublime in his grasp of the philosophical canon, and he did cast his net wide also. And he wasn't oblivious to what we might loosely call the East either, and apparently he attempted a translation of the Tao Te Ching, and was quite influential on the Kyoto school of Japanese philosophers, who were really taken by Heidegger and studied with him directly in some cases, but also had a profound interest in Zen Buddhism. Thinking of Nishida, Nishitani, and these are considerable philosophers who engaged in exchange with Heidegger. So he was a big knob, as we say, hereabouts. So there is this problem for intellectuals around Heidegger's Nazism and his kind of redneck leanings. Now, the thing about cosmopolitanism is this. A cosmopolitan is a citizen of the cosmos. This is what the word means. A politan is a member of a polis, belongs to a polis, a city-state. And cosmos is a word that has survived from ancient Greek into modern English. Cosmos means the entire universe. And it seems that Diogenes, the cynic, was the first person to utter this sentiment on record. And he's a funny fella who lived in a barrel. He'd got some of that kind of Socratic urge to debunk all the presuppositions of his compatriots and of his contemporaries, and to the extent of living in a barrel. he was asked, what polis are you? And he said, I'm a cosmopolitan, I'm a citizen of the world. Anyway, for Heidegger, in the as he outlines it in the Black Notebooks, cosmopolitan is a disaster because it's rootless. A cosmopolitan person is rootless. They can live anywhere. They swan around the world, staying in the great cosmopolitan cities and so forth, and pride themselves of having contacts here, there and everywhere. And of course, cosmopolitanism as an option, as an orientation in the modern world, it's got like fantastic scope now given the information technology. I mean, I regularly spend time discussing matters like this, in fact, with folks from all over the world through the medium of the internet. And so cosmopolitanism is a great option for us in our orientation. I mean, I'm sure in the days of Diogenes, the Mediterranean was a pretty busy place, you know, with a lot of exchange. And we see this in the emergence of Christianity and all the different discursive threads that it syncretised. And Platonism in the Plotinus version, it's a big ingredient. And of course, you know, Jewish, well, Hebraic law, the Old Testament. Of course, the effect on Plotinus of probably Egyptian magic themes and the Egyptian mythological themes brought into Christianity too. And it was a great syncretism. And when it became allied with Roman politics by the conversion of the Emperor Constantine, encouraged by his wife, Faustina, that gave rise to Christianity. So you can see that there was a kind of ferment, the point I'm making here, there was a ferment even then. And people from different cultural enclaves mingled quite a lot. In the ancient world, it's by no means as kind of static as we might envisage it from our readings of history. Human population's been on the move, interchanging, exchanging, conquering, fighting, trading, sharing, since the Neolithic, as far as we can see. But now, in the modern age, you know, this cosmopolitanism is, it's nevertheless increased the possibilities of embracing it, and the encouragement to embrace it, it's increased a thousandfold. And pending apocalypse, it'll continue to do so. It won't always be hunky-dory and pleasant and celebratory, that's for sure. There'll be some wailing and gnashing of teeth also, I've got no doubt. So, anyway, this ethnic nationalist wallah plundering Heidegger's black notebooks kind of points this out, that cosmopolitanism is also rootlessness. And Heidegger, as far as I can make out, seemed to think that ethnic nationalism actually was a kind of a sane option. And this is about being rooted in a place. If you're rooted in a place, you'll take care of it. It's almost how like the Plains Indians took care of the buffalo, because they lived entirely from the herds. They moved with the herds. The herds provided food and raw materials for clothing and making dwellings and all kinds of stuff. So it was in the interest of these tribes to not to actually exterminate the buffalo completely, you know, but to make sure that they thrived and that the numbers were kept up. So there was this kind of care, even in the nomadic people, who nevertheless have a nomadic area, you know, a territory, that there is a rootedness. And you can see how that gives rise to care, just on a very basic level. And he's kind of got a point, and ecologists and ecological philosophers have kind of like taken this from Heidegger. And basically this comes down to Heidegger's notion of the human being. I'm not allowed to say self, I don't think. But it trips off the tongue, doesn't it? You know, that his notion of the self was Dasein, which is being there. Yeah, he's tried to have a phenomenological, non-metaphysical idea of self, or of the human being. Being there, consciousness. So starting there, with just what with our felt lived experience. And he notices that being there contains elements of time, of past, present and future. And Heidegger elsewhere says that the three times are equiprimordial. I think this is a good insight into the nature of how we experience time. In our Dasein, in our being there. And he's saying that from what I can make out. No doubt scholars will correct me, particularly as I don't think that I can give a very nuanced account of this. But he seems to be saying that you were thrown into a circumstance when you're born. You were thrown into life, he uses this. But it's a circumstance in which a particular language is spoken around us. A particular belonging to place is what we land in. A particular community that's enmeshed with a place, with a habitat. And that's what gives rise to having care for the work, for one's corner of the world. And you can see how you could, on this basis, you could construct an argument for cosmopolitanism being an evil. Because it can, in a sense, remove a stake from a place and give rise to, you could argue, the ecological carelessness that human beings have always exhibited, but which has kind of got to the point where it's threatening the very survival of the species. So you can see how you can structure arguments for ethnic nationalism of a kind of an, you know, you can structure a sort of a right greenism, you know, right ecologically aware rightism from these considerations. And I think Heidegger is right to undermine the Cartesian self, which is just like an atom of knowing, just a cognitive atom, pastless, futureless, you know, not thrown into particular circumstances of time, place, culture, language and so on, but more primordial than that. And you can see that Heidegger did the right thing, finding an alternative way of moving forward on human self-understanding, past that Cartesian paradigm. At the same time, this stuff is being used to justify violent defence of imagined slights and hurts to particular ethnic groupings. And obviously, by the time these considerations get down to the level of street demonstrations, you know, they become extremely kind of twisted, truncated and misunderstood. Now, to my mind, Heidegger didn't go far enough with this. And I've said this before, but a part of his Dasein is questioning. I mean, certainly Heidegger's Dasein was one of questioning. This was a man of questions, of many questions, and of profound questions. And an ability to pursue questions in the light of a very comprehensive knowledge and understanding of the philosophical canon, of what people have been thinking for the last 2,500 years. But somehow the ethnic nationalist formulation of Dasein overlooks that questioning. It seems to me that it's pretty primordial, certainly in intelligent human beings. And it becomes kind of pretty obvious the minute you start into any kind of questioning that which you are thrown into and its effects on you are kind of accidental and contingent. And people say, I didn't have to be born here, you know. the reply to which is, the world doesn't know you were living, etc. You know, and you get all these kind of silly debates. But it's that insight into the nature of the particularities of our Dasein that leads precisely to cosmopolitanism. And it seems that, Heidegger overlooks this. Probably because of some kind of blind spot around the question of sympathies, which again I've brought up a couple of times or recently. How far can we extend our sympathies? Because the cosmopolitan is at least theoretically attempting to extend his sympathies to the entire world. One presumes that, that a polis can continue to be a polis in virtue of some kind of solidarity between the members of the polis, between the citizenry, even if it's only sharing a common language. So a cosmopolitan who asserts of themselves that they are cosmopolitan must be at least in the game of attempting some sort of universal sympathy, some Christianity, you might even say, you know, some agape, or at least some sort of solidarity for members of our species regardless of their particularities. Now I do admit it's easier said than done, and otherisation is such a deeply embedded reflex, but it might be a tall order to live up to. You might have to go and live in a barrel like Diogenes to get to this place. But nevertheless, there is this, there's at least this commitment to the desirability of universal sympathy, universal empathy, agape. And by the same token, the alt-right has to make an assertion, a very definite propositional assertion, that they, as a grouping, as an ethnic grouping, are in fact distinct in ways that matter. And they like to give arguments for that, which they attempt to make unimpeachable. Otherwise they've got nothing to theorise about. And they also, following Heidegger, need to root in place and specific culture and specifics of particularity. Whereas the cosmopolitan wants to downplay specifics of particularity, the ethnic nationalist wants to make a big thing of them, and to make sure that those particularities are rendered meaningful and potent as argumentative instruments through the groundwork, through the intellectual groundwork. Now, what I'm saying, I suppose, in short, is that we can harness Heidegger in a completely other direction. It might even be contrary to Heidegger himself. But nevertheless we can, because really the Cartesian notion of self, which has actually dominated in various sort of implicit ways since Descartes, really, it's dominated human self-understanding, definitely needs undoing, you know. And I think we can see that it involves irresponsibility towards the environment at some point, and rootlessness itself. It seems to me that one can actually kind of be rooted in a place, in a farm, in an allotment, on a housing estate or something like that, and yet be a cosmopolitan. And I say this is the yoga question, you know, this question of, well, how far do our sympathies go? How wide does our being, qua being, extend? I mean, some yogis are prepared to say, I am one with everything. Yeah. I mean, that's cosmopolitanism for you. But they would say that in response to the question, well, who am I? What is this contingency? What are these particularities? Where do they come from? What is, how much weight should we give them? And I would say that you can experience the most profound and fiery samadhis that burn everything up. As far as one's particularities are concerned, but nevertheless, they still persist in some way. You don't suddenly stop being able to speak English because you've had these tremendous experiences of a fire that throws you into a complete universalism of sympathy and identity. And for that reason, the impressions of one's early experiences don't, in fact, go away. But what happens is that their value changes, or their import changes. And they might still be extremely poignant within your lived experience. And for me, they certainly are. But at the same time, they don't provide you with any kind of excuse or justification or rationalisation that would enable you to kill other people in its name. They become rather matters to be enjoyed and pondered, because they are parts of the miracle of life. They're beautiful details of the fabric of life, one's own particularities. But at the same time, this, as a result of having asked the yoga question and being given a reply by the fire of things, just adds a whole new dimension to everything. So in a sense, those kind of experiences make one not what one is. At the same time, they make one what one is all the more thoroughly. Yeah. I am and I am not. Let go of I am. Let go of I am not. And a kind of a luminous ordinariness can ensue. And I think Heidegger hints at this, and the fact that his Zen compatriots were able to see some resonance within his work kind of indicates as much as well. And our right-wing alt-right ideologues are missing this. Heidegger himself might have been missing it. You know, and I know it sounds like a kind of vain statement, and no doubt it is. But I actually think that we use the canon, we use our heritage. It provides us with tools. We don't have to kind of kiss the arses of the great philosophers, whilst at the same time, you know, respect where it's due. So cosmopolitanism versus ethnic nationalism. Interestingly, Heidegger devoted 4 volumes to considering the legacy of Nietzsche, and he thought that Nietzsche was the greatest philosopher of the 19th century. At the same time, he takes issue with Nietzsche on matters of the overcoming of metaphysics. Metaphysics in the sense of being able to characterise the being of beings. Heidegger thought that Nietzsche was the last metaphysician. I'd be inclined to think that Nietzsche actually did show the way to the overcoming of metaphysics, and that Heidegger didn't. But the arguments around this are very, very nitty-gritty, finely detailed and so forth. And only geeks like me are interested in them. But I was wondering, in the light of this emergence of this cosmopolitanism versus ethnic nationalism debate that is going on with great urgency all over the place, and violence, I might add, has made me reflect again on the Nietzsche-Heidegger connection. And it might be that we find in Heidegger a desire to deliver the put-down to Nietzsche, because of Nietzsche's cosmopolitanism. You know, if you're going to get all kind of ad hominem and so forth, and psychologistic about stuff, maybe something like that's going on there. Because Nietzsche was a cosmopolitan, definitely. He appreciated discourses and ideas and social forms from all parts of the world and from all times in history. And he was critical, again, of movements and people and ideas, again, from all places and all times in history. Nietzsche was not a fan of the Germans. He wasn't a German nationalist. He was a Europeanist. And there are bits... I was reading the other day something in Beyond Good and Evil, in which Nietzsche is pretty well predicting the European community and the difficulties that that would involve and the benefits that that would involve. Nietzsche was a European. He thought the Germans were beer-drinking dunkops. He was not an anti-Semite. He detested anti-Semitism and was very, very vocal in saying as much, in some very purple terms. And of course, Nietzsche only became the darling of the Nazis because his sister, who was a pal of Hitler's and whose husband set up a neo-Nazi community in Paraguay, expunged all the anti-German, anti-Semitism tropes in the Nietzschean oeuvre. So they were able to kind of pick out some bits. And there are some purple passages in Nietzsche, you know, he was an exaggerated type, you know, and his writer has a kind of an exaggeration and a hyperbole sometimes. But he probably is, you know, a man of the 19th century. Was not immune to some of the prejudices of the 19th century, you know, isn't it? He's not a fucking noisy, he's not a scientist. He says some things that make your hair curl. But he's definitely not a Nazi. He's definitely not a nationalist. Definitely not a German nationalist. Definitely not an anti-Semite. He was kind of in a funny way, an anti-feminist and an anti-socialist. Even though feminists and socialists can get some great insights out of Nietzsche, which are not contrary to their projects. And there's an amazing interest, well, there has been, don't know if it's waning or what now, but amazing interest from feminists in Nietzsche's work and his weird attitudes to women. Anyway, so I think there's something going on there. Also, I think that in times Nietzsche's attitudes to the human particularity and to the self, you might say. I mean, he's one of those people to say alongside the Buddha, Hume, Lao Tzu, Heraclitus, that self don't really exist as a thing because of process. And Nietzsche works through his version of selfish process through the concept of the will to power. And they say, on and off, these remarks are scattered throughout the notebooks and the works. In the posthumous notes, which were collected under the title Will to Power, I think it's number 1080, says something like, the world is will to power, and nothing but will to power, and you, my brothers, he didn't say sisters, by the way, and you, my brothers, are will to power and nothing else besides. And of course, will to power in this scenario is the great flux of things of Heraclitus. It says that points of will to power, not atoms or quarks or whatever, but points of will to power are constantly in interaction, forming alliances, having battles, absorbing each other, repelling each other, reacting and acting. And it's an attempt to give a world picture that's very close to that of the Buddha and also to Heraclitus, of a running reality, and of a running reality that human beings are a part of. But again, she's cosmopolitan, you know. Everybody is will to power. Okay, they have these particularities because they were thrown into a particular community, a particular language group, a particular place. But that's will to power also. Yeah. And that there's something bigger happening. And it's actually something bigger happening that connects us all together. So we are all, in a sense, the same substance. So that might be where Nietzsche's cosmopolitanism might be found, apart from the fact, you know, his love of French literature and Italian music and so on. I suppose the ultimate cosmopolitanism is one which takes cognizance of place, of the thrownness of the individual human being into particular circumstances which they grow up amidst, and which becomes entrenched as they get older into their particularity. And as we know, people get more set in their ways as they get older. And famously, people shift to the right, don't they, as well as they get older. Well, at almost 70, I think I'm actually getting more cosmopolitan, if that's possible. And at the same time, my particularities kind of please me somewhat in some ways. They're entertaining. So, but what I was coming round to saying was simply to remind you of that famous picture of the Earth from space, of that blue globe. You know, there's a place, there's a habitat, there's a community that obviously is in need of our care. You know, but that view from space, the kind of smallness of it, of the Earth in the vastness of space, it's pretty big for us. You know, if you were going to attempt to walk to Vladivostok, you might realise that it's actually, from our point of view, quite big, but from out there, just this speck of dust, you know. And it's a locality, and we can feel it as a locality. And as I keep saying, now the modern technology is bringing that feeling to life in more and more people. At the same time, it's going to be making people who are committed to ethnic nationalism and to place and the contingencies of particularity anxious. It's going to make them anxious as they see this apparent rootlessness, but I'm saying that it doesn't have to be a rootlessness. I do think a certain kind of rootlessness, it probably is a disaster, you know, but at the same time, so is the narrow-mindedness. This is Heidegger's problem, this squint narrow-mindedness of ethnic nationalism. It's pretty damaging. I mean, it was marshalled by the Nazis to unleash one of the biggest disasters in human history across the planet and across our species, namely World War II. This is where that stuff leads to. And it's in the logic of it. It was not a historical accident. To part of the logic, you have to otherwise. To assert one's particularity with a vehemence, one has to otherwise everybody else. Blacks, Jews, Mexican rapists, etc. You get the picture, you know. I mean, for the record, I don't think there is any moral equivalence. Maybe some of these Antifa kids are fucking idiots. Maybe some of them are psychos, you know, looking for a fight. But at the same time, there's no moral equivalence between anti-fascism, broadly understood, and fascism itself. So, that was a lot of stuff, and I think this is going to be part two of left-right, brackets cosmopolitanism, ethnic nationalism. And the other one, the first one I suppose, which I'm hoping you will have heard by now, was dealing a bit more with those concrete events around Charlottesville and so on, even though of course I did attempt to generalise and get a little bit abstract, I suppose, which is kind of the way I go, I suppose. Anyway, pretty well near to town now. So, in summary, there is a discursive tension playing out in the world on all kinds of levels, from Heidegger scholarship right the way down to street riots that you might put loosely as a contestation between groups which espouse cosmopolitanism on the one hand and ethno-nationalism on the other hand, or ethnic nationalism I sometimes call it. I'm saying that some kind of nuanced consideration of this as a philosophical problem actually makes it look a little bit different. And hopefully in a productive way. I think we can only make sense of this if we realise that the question, the yoga question, who am I? Where does this stuff come from? Where do these particularities come from? What is their significance? And so on. But the fire of that question needs to be brought into the equation if it's going to be seen in a productive light and perhaps in a more accurate and nuanced light than it currently is just about everywhere. I think the potential lies in that inquiry for showing us the way out of the labyrinth which is currently leading to great violence and great disaster. Anyway, don't get too apocalyptic there, my friends. So, I shall nip into the town and do a few little bits of business and wish you goodbye.